Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of March 22nd, 2013. We got some unusual mail this week. It was a bright purple postcard that at first glance looked like one of those "You are a winner" mailers. It certainly got our attention, which is exactly the point. It isn't a notice of winnings at all. It's a warning about a new so-called foreign lottery scam. It goes like this. You get an email or a letter or phone call from someone who informs you that you've won a foreign lottery. Now all you need to do to claim your prize is send money to cover the taxes and fees. This scam is so pervasive that the U.S. Postal Service and the AARP came up with the idea of sending out those purple postcards, mostly to homes with older Americans, warning people of the con. Doug Shadell is a former fraud investigator who now serves as director of AARP's Washington State office. Welcome, Doug.
My pleasure to be here.
How are the scammers targeting victims, and what's their storyline?
What they basically do is they call up people who are over the age of 70. They tend to be women who, you know, are lower income folks. And they tell them the good news that they have just won the Jamaican lottery or some kind of a lottery worth $8 million. And all you have to do to get that money is to pay the taxes or the legal fees of $500 or $800, and you're on your way. Well, of course, there is no lottery, and you're just sending your money to thieves, basically.
They're so cunning, though. What if people told you about the scammer's behavior on the phone?
Well, you know, this scam has been around for a long time. The difference now with these folks is just how aggressive they are and how relentless they are. I mean, I interviewed a woman in Maryland a couple weeks ago who was getting 60 calls a day from these people. Now, admittedly, she had sent money, and she's usually told, go down to the Western Union and wire money, or go down to MoneyGram and wire the money, and she had been participating. But historically, con men, once you stop sending money, will leave you alone and go on to the next victim.
So what tone do the scammers take on the phone, and how aggressive do they get?
In the beginning, they're always nice. They're always saying, I'm going to pray for you. I'm asking a lot of personal questions and really being caring. But the minute you stop sending money, that's when it gets really nasty. And we heard one example where a guy actually left a voicemail.
Message received at 1:58 p.m. October 13th. Why you don't want to pick the phone up? Who the are you talking to on the phone? Want me to come over here and set your home on fire? Pick the phone up.
I mean, actual direct threats of coming over there and doing bodily harm to people. And this really has the effect of frightening folks. It would frighten younger folks, but people who are in their 70s or 80s are really frightened by those kinds of things.
Well, what stories have you heard from older people? What do they say really got them? Why they sent that, they wired that $5,000?
There's this thing called the rationalization trap. When you do something like this, you say to yourself, on the one hand, I'm a smart person. On the other hand, I did something stupid. Well, how do you resolve that conflict in your mind? You could either say, I'm stupid, and that's why I did something stupid, which is hard to do. Or I think what happens is you say, I'm a smart person. What I did was not stupid, and I'm going to continue to do it until I prove to the world that it wasn't stupid. And that sort of mentality of throwing good money after bad. And it's really sad. One woman I spoke to said, at first, I did believe it, and then later it was just like, well, maybe I just wanted to believe it. And a lot of people characterize these victims as, well, you're just greedy. These are not people who are doing it to live in a nice mansion. They're doing it so that they can pay their health bills. They're doing it so they can pull themselves out of poverty. And that's really what's being exploited here. You're sort of exploiting the hope of being able to pull yourself up.
What's the most that someone has lost in a scam like this?
I've interviewed people who've lost $300,000 to a scam like this. And you say to yourself, well, if they're low-income people, how do they have $300,000? Well, that's all their money. And some they don't have. I mean, the woman I interviewed last week took out a reverse mortgage on her house. She owned her house free and clear and was convinced by the scammers to take out a loan on her house.
The AARP and the Postal Service collaborated on this mailing to warn people about the scam. But I did think it was funny, your wording. And the warning goes, if you have to send $250 to claim your prize, odds are it's a scam. Odds are? I mean, I don't think there's any doubt, right?
That warning has helped people, though. I just got a call at our call center last week from someone who got that card. And she literally said the following. I got this card in the mail, and an hour later, somebody called me up and told me I'd won the lottery. And I read the card over the phone to them and then hung up on them.
Doug Shadell is the Senior State Director of Washington's AARP. Thanks a lot, Doug, for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
The senior scams that get all the attention nowadays are usually like these foreign lottery cons. They involve some kind of technology, like phone calls or emails. But the old school scams, the on-the-street, face-to-face, grifter ones, they haven't gone anywhere. In this week's Senior Moment, commentator Judy Muller explains why aging boomers can be such easy marks.
Many years ago, when my then 70-year-old father came to visit me in New York City, he was scammed by a guy at Penn Station who told him that he would hail a cab for my father and that his fee for doing so would also cover the cab fare. My dad happily handed over $25 to that guy and was horribly embarrassed when the cab driver told him he'd been scammed. I remember how shocked I was that my father, a retired Navy captain and a very smart guy, could be so gullible. Well, now there's a study that explains it, just in time for my own gullible years. Researchers at UCLA say that seniors' vulnerability to fraud is apparently rooted in neurological changes that come with aging. The study found that an area in the brain known as the anterior insula was muted when older people looked at photos of suspicious-looking individuals. In other words, they had trouble reading visual cues, like insincere smiles and shifty eyes. In the words of one of the scientists, "We believe that what's going on is that older adults have a bias towards positive emotional experience, something called the positivity effect." I'd like to look on the bright side here. After all, my anterior insula is urging me to do just that. But statistics indicate that there's a downside to this upbeat attitude. The National Committee for the Prevention of Elder Abuse reports that financial scams involving older victims are on the rise. Elder fraud, ranging from bank accounts being emptied by so-called trusted caretakers to fake sweepstakes, totaled $2.9 billion in 2010. That's a 12% increase from the year before. Not a good trend as more and more boomers move into old age. So what's a gullible senior to do? Perhaps just knowing that you can't really trust your own instincts is a start. If my dad had been armed with this information about his anterior insula, would he have paused before handing over his cash to a total stranger? I'd like to think so.
Judy Muller is a professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School. It seems like con artists are dreaming up new scams every week. And that has us thinking. The subject deserves a whole show to itself. So we're researching all the scams out there that are plaguing people, and seniors in particular. If you've been a victim of fraud, or if you know of anyone who's fallen for a con, we want to hear your story. You can reach us on our Facebook page, on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank, that's all one word, or via our website, marketplacemoney.org. Remember the Aesop fable about the ant and the grasshopper? Well, these days, when it comes to retirement, more Americans are acting like grasshoppers than ants. According to a new report from the Employee Benefit Research Institute, just shy of 60% of retirees say they have less than $25,000 saved. And only about half of us have even taken the time to figure out what we'll need to live on after we retire. If older Americans are finding it hard to save, when they're staring retirement in the face, think how much harder it must be for millennials. Retirement seems so far away to them, for one thing. And then there's the struggling economy, stagnant wages, and heaping student debt. Recently, some of our colleagues at Youth Radio got together to share what they're expecting from life after work.
So what I imagine is like kind of like in those commercials for medicine, you know, where it's like you're old and you're carrying a kayak on the beach and your dog is behind you and you've got a little beach house and a swing, you know, something like that.
I also am going to have a beach house, but it's going to be on a separate beach.
From mine?
From yours. And I also want to just paint pictures and like sell books and like have like a really cool hangout space where you can make art and talk.
I actually don't envision either of those things. I feel like between the ages of 62 and 65, I just need to have enough money to be able to support myself and pay my bills. and just be happy. Maybe I'll have like a side job as like a Walmart greeter or something.
Yeah, see, the medicine commercial is the dream, but in reality it'll most likely be something like that, I imagine.
I'll
just live in an apartment or something, and you know, hopefully my kids will help me pay for things. I'll probably stay with Asha.
I can't even save money, you know, for my car right now that I want. So why would I think about retirement when I'm super old?
Yeah, I feel like there are so many other things that I should start saving for.
All the hard work I have to do right now, and like not having a car now, and not having like designer stuff now, like I'll be able to have it later when I have better taste.
I think what it would take for me to really start saving towards my retirement is to actually get an education about how to do that. No one's ever sat down with me and been like, this is what you need to do. These are the smartest ways to go about this.
When I think about retirement, I think about like having a 401k or something, a pension. I don't really know what these things are.
See,
but I know
exactly.
You get those things when you have like a for real job and you're full-time and you have health insurance. And so right now I'm trying to get to that, to a job where I'm full-time, I have health insurance. The goal right now is to start my career somewhere where I can, that's like in the paperwork that I signed, that's a part of that. So until I can get to that, I can't think of what comes after that. But then I can like relax, you know, on my like imaginary beach house.
And that's 21-year-old Asha Richardson, 18-year-old Ashley Williams, and 20-year-old Sarah Cavedo, talking in the studios of Youth Radio in Oakland, California. As we mull over the new research about Americans' difficulties planning for retirement, some of the reasons seem obvious, but others, not so much. Our next guest, Douglas Rushkoff, has his own theory about this. He argues that when you're living in a very urgent present, swimming in a flood of tweets and status updates and a 24/7 news cycle, the future, and saving for it, can lose priority. He writes about the implications of this in his new book, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Doug, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be with you.
So what you write about in this book is so familiar to my daily life that it almost doesn't require explaining. But in the interest of getting our terms straight, what exactly do you mean by present shock?
Well, present shock is really the human reaction to living in a world that it's always on and kind of pinging you from everywhere. And I guess on a deeper level, it's about living in a world kind of without history and without a future, where everything is happening in the present tense. You know, so how do you run your life or your business or anything about you when you don't really have a temporal landscape in which to do it?
Well, let's get to the personal finance ramifications, starting with retirement and these findings from the Employee Benefit Research Institute study. It sounds as if Americans can't even think about retirement as well as we used to. What do you think is at work here?
Well, on the biggest level, you know, our whole retirement paradigm is based on this, you know, industrial age idea of doing stuff now for some future reward.
Right. Storing your nuts for a...
Right. Store your nuts for some future thing.
Well, is it that we can't believe in a future anymore because the idea, you know, of storing up our nuts for the future doesn't work anymore, that it can all come crashing down at any moment? Or has our essential relationship to time and our experience of time changed?
Well, both. I mean, on the one hand, investors don't invest anymore anyway. You know, you look at, you know, say the IPO of Facebook, and, you know, people were upset. They bought the shares at 9 in the morning, and at 9:15, they hadn't gone up. It's like, what's the problem here? You know, so they're not
very
investing.
Short idea of the future.
Exactly. But they're not investing in stocks anymore, right? They're investing in the trade. Right. They're trying to make money off the transaction itself in real time. You know, God forbid we start thinking about the company that's supposed to be underlying the stock.
Well, the real time is very divorced from the consequences.
Right. But people don't really do things for the consequences anymore. We don't, you know, do something now for some later reward. We don't do some cause for some effect. It's actually everything happens kind of in the moment for its own sake, which is both, you know, frightening and short term on the one hand, but it's very real on the other hand.
Well, you also examine borrowing and debt and the irrational ways that we go about that, and whether it's taking on adjustable rate balloon mortgages or 0% initial fee credit card promotions. But our human decision making has always been plagued by emotion and irrationalities. So how are these behaviors any different than the boneheaded things we've always done with our money?
Well, yeah, our financial choices have always been, you know, predicated on some psychobehavioral flaws, if we want to, you know, pick on people. But the difference is now, you know, that banks and investment firms and credit card companies have entire divisions of highly paid psychologists trying to help them figure out how to exploit these irrational tendencies. I mean, and that's the part that's really, it's kind of not fair. You know, when you have the very industries that are being entrusted with our future, they're looking for ways to make money off our bad choices. I mean, that's why it really doesn't work so well anymore.
Well, it's curious. At the same time that there are more people unable to plan ahead for retirement, there are also more people planning ahead for the apocalypse, these so-called preppers who are building bunkers or putting down payments on underground apartments that are designed to withstand the end of the world.
Yeah, it's funny. In the book, I call that apocalypto. You know, it's a lot easier for people to imagine a zombie apocalypse, right, where all you have to do is protect your family on the top of a little hill somewhere and, you know, shoot a few zombies as they come up. It's easier to imagine that than, you know, what's going to happen next year or even next month. You know, and that sort of anxiety leads to these this whole prepper mentality where we'd kind of rather everything come ending in a fiery apocalypse than just keep on going somehow the way it is.
Douglas Rushkoff's new book is Present Shock: When Everything Happens Now. Doug, it was great to talk with you. Thank you.
It's great to talk with you.
Speaking of living in the present, April 15th is almost here, and you're probably already hearing people grouse about the taxes they have to pay. And not just on earnings, on gas, on food, and if they live in a high tax state like New Jersey, on property. But Jersey girl Jen Miller isn't complaining. She's run the numbers, and she reckons she's getting a deal.
New Jersey has the highest property taxes of any state in the U.S. I own a row home with a postage-sized stamp yard in the town of Collingswood, and I pay about $5,000 a year in property tax. On paper, living in Collingswood looks like an unwise financial decision. But consider the alternatives. I could pay a fifth of my current property taxes if I moved over the bridge to Philadelphia. But then I'd have to pay taxes on my wages, a business tax since I'm self-employed, plus pony up for a business license. These are all things I don't have to pay in Collingswood. Okay. So I can move to a suburb of Philadelphia on the Pennsylvania side. My sister and her husband live in one, and she pays for trash and recycling pickup, which are services included in my taxes. Plus, she's considering private school for her two sons because the schools aren't that great. Ka-ching! Sure, I could pick up and move to Florida, where I went to college. But then I'd be whacked with a 7% sales tax on things like clothing, unprepared food, medicines, and household paper products. New Jersey's tax on those items? Zero. My point is this. It's not all about dollars and cents when it comes to where you live. Collingswood is a small, friendly town with an active downtown, a farmer's market, and a commuter train to Philadelphia. Our streets are tree-lined, our crime level's low, my dog has a backyard, and my family is here. I have dug roots in deep. Could I save a few bucks by moving across the bridge? Perhaps. Would I rather pay less in property taxes? Of course. But for my own slice of Garden State heaven, those bucks are worth it.
Jen Miller is a freelance writer, author, and proud denizen of the Garden State, to which, as a Philly girl, I can only say she knows what bridge to take to get a decent cheesesteak. Now, if Jen's waxing about taxes has got you thinking about your 1040, here's something to consider. Not only is April tax month, it's also National Poetry Month. So if you're in the mood to compose an ode to your Schedule C or a haiku about your W-2, just send it over to us. There's a prize in it for the winner. Reach us on Facebook, on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank, and on MarketplaceMoney.org. Each week, we welcome questions about money from all of you. And do feel free to get in touch at MarketplaceMoney.org if you're struggling with a personal finance decision. We have the chance to put you in touch with some of the best pros out there. And one of our favorite advisors is Carmen Wong Ulrich, author of The Real Cost of Living, Making the Best Choices for You, Your Life, and Your Money. And she joins us today to set us all straight. Welcome back to the show, Carmen.
Thanks, Barbara. Great to be here.
Well, let's dive right in, shall we? You ready to take some calls?
Yep, ready.
First up, we have Jamie calling in from Minneapolis. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Hi.
Hey there. What's on your mind today?
Well, I've been a stay-at-home mom for about 2.5 years, and it recently came up that I tried to apply for a credit card and found out that because I don't have income and I don't have enough what they called revolving credit history, I wasn't able to get one.
Oh, I am so steamed up as a woman, a wife, and a mother. I can barely sit here.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, do you have a checking account or a savings account in your own name or your own?
It's a joint account with my husband, and it's through the credit union at his work.
How about retirement savings? Anything in your name?
I do have a 401k in my name.
So your question is, what's going on?
Yeah. How do I build some revolving credit or... what do I do? What's my first step? I know that I've always heard that applying for credit cards and getting denied kind of dings your credit history, and I don't want that to happen.
Well, Jamie, not necessarily. It's more so the fact that you're being rejected. I mean, and here's the thing, ladies, and Barbara, you got steamed too. You know, with the Card Act of 2010, which brought about a lot of good change, one part of the change that I'm not happy about is the fact that you must have income in order to get credit. Now, the danger of that was they put that in place to protect college students from all those card solicitors. But the problem was that stay-at-home parents got hit badly by this. So, Jamie, the first thing you need to do is you absolutely need to build credit in your name. Any and all stay-at-home parents, you need credit in your name. You need a checking account, savings account in your name, retirement accounts. These things must be there because, unfortunately, stuff happens. And you need all those things to lean on should anything happen. So to build your credit, Jamie, go for a secured credit card. Now, a secured card, think of it as a card that you put basically a security deposit down on. So let's say $500 is down on the card. They hold that and then extend you equal credit. Now, you don't draw down the money since it's a security deposit, but you must use the card responsibly, and that is your limit. Once you do that, and every month you use it, let's say you use it just for gas or groceries, and then you pay it off in full every month, you start to build credit. And then you'll eventually be extended credit. But the cool thing about secured cards is that you can choose one that's going to report to all the credit reporting agencies so that it builds your credit.
Great. That sounds like a really good first step.
Jamie, one more thing. I know many women in your situation have formed investment groups. I'm thinking that might be a nice support for you. You know, power in numbers.
Sure, sure.
Team up.
Thanks for the advice.
Good luck. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Jamie.
Carmen, I thought you might suggest, because in the old days, you would go to a department store and get a credit card.
Well, credit is credit. So the department store would probably reject her as well.
Ah, back in the day, it was very easy. They'd just throw them at you.
Yeah, back in the day, we could get, I mean, I remember my dad, our dog was getting credit card offers back in the day. And so he would fill out magazine subscriptions with the dog's name, and then we get the credit card offers in the dog's name. But so, yeah, I mean, things have definitely changed. And you know, there is quite a vocal group right now who's kind of trying to fix this fact because it does handicap stay-at-home parents. So if you are planning on staying at home, make sure that you keep credit in your name and you keep using your own cards and just pay it off in full. Just use it for one thing so you don't go crazy and just keep that credit going.
Okay, I'm still boiling a little bit over that, but moving on. Let's stay in wintry Minneapolis. That's where our next caller is. Grace, welcome to Marketplace Money.
Hi.
Hey there. So from your email, it looks as if you are one of our very financially put together listeners. Congratulations.
Yeah, kind of lucky.
Yeah, tell us about yourself.
I have been out of college now for just about 3 years. I luckily don't have any college debt to pay off. And I'm kind of at that point where I'm starting to look a couple years down the road and thinking that I might want to, you know, have kids and be able to house and feed them and things like that. And I'm also not super nuts about my job, and I'm also considering that I might want to, you know, start my own business in a couple years. And I'm kind of just wondering about how to save money, you know, between now and retirement. I've got an IRA and a 401k and stuff like that, but I want to sort of be prepared for maybe 10 to 20 years down the line, and I'm not sure where to put the money that I'm saving to do that well.
Grace, you wrote us that in your email that someone had approached you trying to sell you some permanent life insurance policy at your age with no kids.
Yeah, and that I had never heard of it, and I, you know, ran it by my dad, and he's like, you're 25, you don't really need life insurance.
That really makes me angry, because insurance is a product that is sold, unfortunately, and it does have a lot of high commissions, so it tends to be pushed. And you have to be very, very savvy about not just looking at, oh, the return, and oh, the tax-free, and all that stuff, but looking at actually the parameters of it, which means your money would be locked up.
Hey, Grace, one more question for me, and just tell me to butt out if this is too personal. But you have a boyfriend that you say is planning perhaps to go to graduate school. Are you planning to support him, or at least partially support him through that?
No, I mean, right now he's in school, and, you know, he pays his half of the rent, and I pay my half, and he's, you know, paying for school on his own. So that's kind of, we're keeping our finances separate at this point still.
Smart all the way around. Yeah, you're way ahead.
Good
way
going,
ahead of me.
Grace. Keep it that way.
Thanks for calling in. We'll have you advise people next letters segment.
All right. Well, thank you so much, you guys.
Thanks again. Take care. Well, rounding out our tour today, Carmen of the Midwest, we have Nuruddin calling us from Flint, Michigan. And hello, what a beautiful name. Am I garbling it, Nuruddin?
No, that's actually how you say it. That was really good.
Well, where do you come from originally?
I'm from Lagos, Nigeria.
What brought you to Flint?
So Kettering University College, basically.
Ah, is that where you went to engineering school, as you wrote us?
Yes, I did graduate in December.
Ah, now what would you like to run by Carmen today?
Yes, so basically I have a gift from my parents, so of some money, but I have to invest it in something long-term, so basically an investment in my future. But I'm not entirely sure how I can do that in the United States, because I've tried maybe, you know, going through maybe Charles Schwab or somebody like that and see if I can invest in the stock market. But I can't exactly do that since I'm not a citizen, I guess.
Okay, so electrical engineering, at least we know you're probably good with math. How much money are we talking here, if I may ask?
$10,000.
Okay, so a starter nest egg, Carmen. What should Nuruddin do?
Nuruddin, I realize that seems like a lot of money, but I worry that it's not necessarily enough to be worth the cost of getting tangled up in taxes and other fees and all that sort of thing that you may get if you invest and need, let's say, to go back and want to take the money back. I totally understand your parents saying you need to invest this money, you know, not spend it like crazy. But if there's a way that you can kind of hold on to this for a bit until you're out of school and you're situated, are you planning on working in the United States?
Maybe 2 years, but I would have to go back home, though. I have OPT, which is like something you get for like a year after the visa.
Right. And see, that's the thing, is that if you're going back, you don't want to lock this money up in a U.S. investment that could cost you more in terms of, you know, getting entangled and stuff. Also, I think it's good to see if you end up getting a visa or getting a different status. Let's say if you get a great job offer. And that's the good thing about, you know, after college, like the world is open to possibilities, and you could get this amazing offer that keeps you in the States for a while. And you may need that money to get an apartment and furnish it and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I just feel like, you know, when you get out of school, there's just so much that's up in the air that I'm not a fan of just saying, oh, yeah, let's just, you know, let's put it in the market. You can go through one of the big boys, you know, Schwab, Fidelity, whoever, and you can't. It's not necessarily that you can't. It's that there's a lot of rules about it, and there's taxes, and there's situations in your own country in terms of bringing the money back. So you just want to be a little savvy about that. But it's definitely not worth right now you worrying about, where am I going to sink this money in, so much as let me just protect it and hold on to it and then see what happens when I graduate.
And what does that mean? What should he do with it?
Really, just hold on to it in a savings account in the bank. I'm not kidding. some folks may disagree and say, oh, you know, no, let's take advantage of the housing market or this market or that. I err on the side of caution with all of these things, especially since when you're young, things are a little tumultuous.
So you have a really nice emergency fund, Nuruddin.
Yes. Or a startup or a personal startup, you know, career fund.
Right. Now you just have to get through, you know, advanced circuitry or whatever else you do in EE in grad school. Best of luck with that.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Well, that brings us to the end of our calls today. Carmen, my head is always clearer after listening to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Thanks so much for having me.
Carmen Wong Ulrich is a personal finance journalist. Her most recent book is The Real Cost of Living. And thanks again for this.
Thank you.
When it comes to healthcare, there is no more expensive time of life than when we're approaching death. 10% of all healthcare dollars are spent in the last year of life. That adds up to $270 billion. This is the time when the toughest and costliest decisions are made, and emotions can easily overrun the best intentions. We're bringing you a story today of one man, Richard Dean, and his struggle to decide what's best for his dying wife, Janet. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Janet Dean wasn't supposed to spend her final days like this.
She must have had 40 pounds of fluid, so her face was all swollen. She had the breathing tube in there that was taped to her face.
Gone was Rich Dean's sweetheart, the bathing beauty he met as a lifeguard back at Orchard Beach in 1964. This 44-year marriage between the daughter of a New York City cab driver and the son of a New York City bus driver was nearly over.
At the end, you know, she wasn't the woman I loved. She wasn't the Janet that I lived with. She was this organism that was struggling on the table.
This wasn't the plan. Doctors had told Janet in the spring of 2009 the pain in her stomach was actually stage 4 ovarian cancer. She and Rich quickly, easily, made a pact. The pact lots of us make when we think about death. Rich remembers his wife's words.
Don't extend this more than it needs to be. You know, if I don't have a good chance at life, then I'll happily accept my death.
So how did they end up here, where the desire for a quiet, unplugged death unravels and a loving husband breaks a final promise? Rich says he sees it now. As his wife lay there in the ICU, she was dying. But he couldn't see it then.
I think what happens is when you're in the midst of a medical crisis, you actually don't know where you are. You don't have any sense of, am I a day away from dying? Is recovery possible? We actually don't know then.
Rich had promised his wife he wouldn't pull out all the stops to keep her alive, that she would die at home, surrounded by her family, not like this, in an ICU hooked up to machines.
I was her caregiver, that I would be there, that I knew her wishes. That wasn't the way she wanted to be, and that wasn't the way she wanted to leave.
Again, he did what many people do when hope starts running out. He looked at Janet's team of doctors and nurses, counting on modern medicine to rescue them both.
Medical people find it hard to deal with that. I mean, so they've got to do something. You know, we'll do this, we can do this, we can do this.
It was a Hail Mary. A super rare antibiotic, so exceptional that Rich says one course of the drug cost $20,000.
The doctors said if we did this, it would give her a chance to get back to where she was, which was maybe a 3 or 5% chance of recovery.
Yeah, a 3 to 5% chance. The very definition of an extraordinary measure, where the doctors, the hospital, the patient, the insurers together take a flyer on a crazy expensive attempt to help one person live a little bit longer, maybe. From a policy perspective, it's madness. But if it's your mother or your son or the wife you promised would die in her own bed surrounded by family, then it's different, right? Doctors administered the first shot. It didn't work.
I looked into her eyes and she looked into my eyes. And we connected, and I told her I loved her, and I got her best effort at a smile, and I knew.
To this day, 3 years later, Rich regrets his decisions, the rounds and rounds of chemo, the slippery slope to the ICU, and especially the shot. He thinks about wasted resources, whether some other person could have actually used those antibiotics. But mostly, he blames himself for letting the situation spin out of control, for losing sight of what his wife wanted most.
I needed to have done more. You know, it was a traumatic time for me, so that image stays with me. And the rational side of me understands that I did the best I could. But I feel like, well, I could have done better.
The way Janet died cost Rich, and it cost us. The biggest chunk of healthcare spending takes place in the last year of life, $270 billion. People are at their sickest, and emotion often drives costs more than medicine. Some healthcare people believe we're not too far from a time when the healthcare system will do a better job letting us know when it's time to let go. For Rich, in his final days, he's going to look his doctors in the eye and demand to know when it's his time. At least, he says, that's his plan. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Lately, we've been checking in on real estate markets around the country. Most of our conversations with realtors have been rather sunny. Too sunny, in fact, for listener Wendy Phillips.
I responded to the realtors' conversation about Atlanta and how the housing market was improving and that it was positive for people looking for homes, and my experience has been different. The neighborhood where I live, and we've been here for over 25 years, what I'm observing is houses popping up for sale, continually people moving out, and sometimes groups of houses with sold signs appearing overnight, which makes me think that they're investors that are buying the properties. They get cleaned up, and then they're put up for rent. Sometimes people stay a few months, sometimes a little longer, and move out again. So it feels very transient, very different from the way it used to be.
Wendy's perspective goes to show that while experts talk about a housing market recovery across the U.S., every neighborhood in every city is having a very different real estate experience. And what's true in Atlanta is also true in Santa Barbara. The city may be home to many of the rich and famous, but it's having its share of problems. Santa Barbara recently topped a list of the hottest places to buy property in a short sale. That attracted our attention and prompted us to get in touch with realtor and short sale specialist Heidi Crossman. Heidi, welcome.
Thank you.
So living here in Los Angeles, I've made a few day trips to Santa Barbara. And at least for a tourist, I have to say it mostly lives up to the cliche. It is a beautiful downtown that seems like a kind of playground for the rich and famous. But why don't you set the record straight for us? What's it really like to live in Santa Barbara?
It costs a lot of money. We pay for the weather. We pay for our views next to the beach. And of course, Montecito, where Oprah has her $20 million mansion. We pay for that too.
Oh, I'm sure.
Homes here are wonderful. I think Santa Barbara is one of the very few cities in the country that actually price their homes by the zip code.
Why don't you tell us about the kinds of homes that you deal with?
Lately, I've been dealing with a lot of the bank-owned homes, REOs, and short sales.
And that's so surprising to think of short sales and foreclosures in Santa Barbara. How many of the properties do you have listed right now that are short sales?
I don't have any current listings right now, but I just closed three of them that were bank-owned. This year, I have listed and closed five in the Santa Barbara County, and last year, probably about 20.
So it seems like as if it's tapering off. Is that correct?
You know what it is? The thing about Santa Barbara, we don't have a lot of homes listed. Currently, we only have 623 active listings, that's active and pending together, and then only 280 of those are single-family homes. So it sounds like we've just got a whole bunch of short sales and foreclosures here, where in reality, we don't have that many home listings. So the short sales and the foreclosures are quite a lot, especially this last year. But now we have actually, our inventory has depleted quite a bit this year. So I don't think we're going to see the short sales and foreclosures like we did last year.
Well, I'm interested in your clients. And I said earlier that many of your clients are first-time buyers and they speak English as a second language.
Y si habla español. I speak Spanish fluently, and actually in real estate, my first buyers were a Spanish-speaking couple. They only spoke Spanish, and my first transaction was an $800,000 home here in Santa Barbara with them.
Oh, they must have been so happy to find you.
They had been renting for years, and this was their first home, and it was wonderful. And the median price here, depending on who you ask, on the web, I've seen the median price in the 200,000s to 340, but according to our MLS, our median price range here is 830,000.
Well, it just goes to show how hard it is to get a fix on what's going on with real estate.
Right, and most of the buyers are in the 400 to 500,000 price range.
Well, I think you're the person asked for an insider tip, so this is just between us. No one will know. What's the best deal in Santa Barbara on the housing market right now?
Because there's such a shortage of listings right now, I think the best deals that you'll find are probably in Lompoc, which is, 45 minutes an hour north, and it's part of Santa Barbara County. But in Lompoc, they have great prices with better homes, just more for your money. But not a lot of people want to live in Lompoc. It's windy and it's cold most of the time.
And maybe not as many celebrities.
Not as many celebrities in Lompoc. Absolutely not.
Heidi Crossman specializes in bank-owned properties, first-time buyers, and short sales. She lives in the beautiful Santa Ynez Valley and represents clients in Santa Barbara and surrounding areas. Heidi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Barbara. I really appreciate it.
If the real estate market in your neighborhood is playing out differently from the way it's being portrayed in the national media or on this show, let us know. You can reach us on Facebook or via our website, marketplacemoney.org. Well, very few of us are lucky enough to snap up short sales in places like Santa Barbara. But almost all of us face one very basic financial decision, where to put our money. The financial crisis and its fallout cast Wall Street banks in a very poor light and sent many people looking for alternative places to stash their cash. Some turned to credit unions, but at least initially, many found them lacking. Over the last few years, however, credit unions have stepped up their game. This week, the consumer website Bankrate released its 2013 survey of credit unions. Greg McBride is the senior financial analyst there. Hey, Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's say I want to open a new account today. Make the pitch. Why should I opt for a credit union over a bank?
Well, I think what people need to do is at least consider credit unions. This is not a one-size-fits-all solution by any means, but I think when you look at how compelling the offers can be from credit unions, and we found that more than 70% of the nation's largest credit unions offer a free checking account. That's about twice the pace that we see among banks. I think that warrants them at least being in the conversation.
Well, how can they afford to do that, offer that free checking?
Well, credit unions are a couple of things. First, by nature, they're not-for-profit cooperatives. The other thing is free checking at many credit unions has been a staple long before it became fashionable among banks to do so. So even confronted with higher regulatory and compliance costs, as many banks have also faced, credit unions have other levers that they can pull before they need to start instituting fees on checking accounts. So, for example, a checking account that used to pay interest, they may convert that to non-interest. They may eliminate other products and services, those kind of things, before they have to actually start instituting fees on their members.
Well, in contrast then, what are the advantages that a bank can offer?
I think a lot of the advantages and a lot of the reasons that a lot of people, when they're switching banks, still go to either another bank or one of the large banks is that the desire to be able to bank, for example, from mobile capabilities is best among the larger banks. And that's something that particularly those under age 30 really strive for. So I think that's a real competitive advantage. Credit unions tend to be later adopters of that type of technology, but it's still coming. A lot of credit unions have added mobile banking, and there are still more adding it every day. But you know, the ability to bank anytime, anywhere, and on your own terms, to the extent that consumers desire that, they're finding that first and most easily at banks. But the trade-off is that you're often seeing less availability of things like free checking.
What about ATMs? How much of a problem is that for credit union users, especially if it's a small one?
Not so much anymore. And the credit unions have made big strides to really level the playing field in that regard. A lot of very small credit unions belong to much larger ATM networks. I mean, one of the largest ATM networks out there is the Co-op network, and it's a credit union ATM network. They have more than 30,000 ATMs around the country. So a lot of small credit unions that have one or two branches and only a handful of ATMs may easily open up thousands of ATMs to their members that they can use free of charge around the country by participation in one of these larger networks.
Well, credit unions weren't lagging behind just on mobile technology. Just a few years ago, a lot of people went to join credit unions, found that they were just poorly staffed and they only had a handful of branches, and the technology was really outdated, you know, like 1980s outdated. How substantially has that changed?
Well, there's 7,000 credit unions in the country, so I hesitate to paint with too broad a brush, but a lot of credit unions by nature, they're very small and they may have been affiliated with one employer or affinity group or university, but those fields of membership have expanded. And so a lot of credit unions are now bigger, either through consolidation or just by expanding fields of membership. And I think a lot of people will find that they have a lot of the same capabilities that they do at their banking counterparts.
Well, they sound great. I'm tempted to sign up. So can anyone join?
And depending on where you live, yes, anybody can join. And by that, I mean there are what are known as community credit unions. These are credit unions that have a charter that allows anybody that lives, works, or attends school within that particular community to become a member of the credit union. So that's an example of, you know, the broadest application. There are other credit unions that, as I said earlier, they may have started out being affiliated with one employer, but they have really expanded that field of membership and now may be eligible to dozens of other employers in that area. Universities. Credit unions often have an affiliation with a particular university, so students, faculty, their family may find that to be a viable avenue as well.
Greg McBride is Senior Financial Analyst at Bankrate. Greg, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
And that'll do it for Marketplace Money for this week. Tell us what you think of the show at marketplacemoney.org. And we can also keep in touch on our Facebook page. Or if Twitter is your social media of choice, you can follow us there at Radio Piggy Bank. Next week, we team up with the New York Times to explore the various ways our emotions can mess with our money.
No matter how much you love someone, it's a risk to be responsible for their financial behavior. I don't want to take that risk anymore. I don't think anybody should, frankly.
Why we should keep our hearts separate from our wallets. A special collaboration with the Your Money section of the New York Times. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Paranada. Special thanks this week to Gina Delvac. Brendan Willard is our engineer. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Barbara Bogave. Have a great weekend, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.